has cilia sensors that are many atoms wide. So I think it requires a wee bit more force than that. But in addition, it also goes into the explanation of falling meteorites, because otherwise, if you think about falling meteorites, you really shouldn't hear them until they really hit the atmosphere and produce vibration. But if they're producing a lot of RF, they can work on the same mechanism. And people have described these types of noises as hissing and clicking and all manner of things.
There are people who think they hear a sound when they're seeing an aurora, and I believe that's a very difficult one to confirm, as I see it there right now.
Well, supposedly in the literature, they bunch all three of them together. They say that brontophonics are related to lightning and can be related to meteorites and can be related to auroras as well by the same sort of mechanism. And, I've heard all kinds of semi-ridiculous explanations that people only think that they hear sound because in many cases, no one bothered to record them. But I don't know. It seems that there's a lot of good reasoning behind these things. I personally don't have a big problem with induced RF detection into some kind of strange localized air pressure.
Are you saying that the aurora event is changing the local air pressure of the air in the vicinity of the observer? Is that what you're saying, Elroy?
Not directly. I'm saying that it's inducing RF emission that might be interacting with something more local that's going through some nonlinear conductor being detected into a lower frequency signal that's heating locally the air and causing local atmosphere by way of RF exchange.
KC2LR.
LR? Go right ahead. Say something. You go first.
Hi, this is AC2LR. Just recently, I heard a science show on brontophonic sounds. It was, I think, Radiolab, and they were. Well, all I can remember from it is that either Inuits or Eskimos frequently hear a clicking noise in their heads when the auroras are present. And there are certain tribes that think this means something bad. I think the clicking in their head, they think it's a demon or something. And what they do is put their tongue against the roof of their mouth, which actually is adjusting their ears in some way. And the clicking goes away, and they think they have that a blessing of some sort to remove the demon from the area. Something like that. And I'm trying to find it on my cell phone, but I can't find the name of the show. I'm sorry. But I just wanted to contribute that to the conversation. This is AC2LR. Back to you, Dick.
We should send this back to Roy. I'm going to guess, Roy, that that could be the visual effect creates some other effect in the human brain. There are people who will see certain letters and they see a color when they're reading a particular letter, for instance. There's a kind of cross-coupling going on. I can give you another example of that, but back to you, Roy.
Yeah, they call that synesthesia. You can, numbers have colors, objects have sounds attached to them. It's a cross-wiring in the human. So one of the possible reasons that have been put forth is a more a psychological, I think, than neurophysiological phenomena, that the lights seem to kind of cross-create a sensory aspect of noises. It's for the many, many cases when people don't carry around recording equipment, which up until very recently people didn't. So I think that nowadays that people have more cell phones, we might get a few more recordings of these things to disprove that it's all in our heads. But we'll see. But it's sort of interesting, once again, that this is something that's been going on for human civilization for so long, and we have still so many questions about it.
In your previous transmission, Roy, you were speculating that the aurora could be making a very large radio sound. My experience says that the radio sound coming from the aurora is a very weak radio sound. I have particularly, on a few hundred occasions, bounced signals on 432 megacycles off of the aurora curtain. Talk to guys who do 6-meter work, serious sideband work on 6 meters, and they have often bounced 6-meter signals off the aurora. When they aim their antenna toward the aurora, you would like to think they're going to hear a whole lot of noise. They do hear some noise, but not a great deal. It's a threshold signal. So the amount of broadband radio noise of an aurora, in general, is very weak. I didn't hear it at 432. The 6-meter people do hear some noise on aurora. I know that the people on HF frequencies, when they aim toward an aurora event, they do hear a lot of noise. But is it coming from the aurora, or is it being reflected from the aurora? On your HF frequencies, you get an awful lot of noise of thunderstorms around the world, and they could be reflecting off the aurora. So an awful lot of what's called aurora noise, I think, is a reflection noise, not necessarily created by the aurora itself. That's an opinion. Over to you, Roy, KQRIW.
It very well may be that it's not originating, but it's being used to reflect back down, and there might be localized short-term propagation conditions. Might focus the beam a bit to the threshold where the people will pick up those types of sounds. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I've never, unfortunately, seen an aurora, certainly not heard an aurora, so I don't know for myself. But again, there's nothing in this that would incredibly surprise me or make me doubt it because it violates one of the laws of physics. So it's a good possibility. We'll see.
If I was using a radio transmitter into a good beam antenna on, let's say, 28 megacycles, the 10-meter band, and I aimed it at the aurora curtain, I'm having difficulty seeing the mechanism by which charged particles of the solar wind coming from the sun hitting the atmosphere in the North Pole region of the Earth, how could it make a cyclic noise at 28 million cycles per second in order to be picked up by my antenna? The mechanism by which it could make a signal at a high frequency rate strikes me as being a little bit difficult. Over to you, Roy, KQRIW.
I don't know. I mean, all this is high-energy plasmas. Don't plasmas usually have a wide spectrum of RF noise associated with them?
Locally, absolutely yes. If I strike an arc in a piece of waveguide by putting a lot of RF energy into that waveguide, and I've got some kind of a sharp-edged object in there that initiates a corona discharge, which becomes an arc. Locally, when in that waveguide, your receiver is inches or feet away from that arc, and the arc itself is making a lot of local noise. And you've got a closed environment where any noise being made can't escape. It's going to go out one end or the other end of the waveguide, and your receiver's going to pick it up. But if now that arc is in open air and being dissipated by an inverse square law, and you and I are, let me pick a number, 500 miles away from that aurora curtain, and we want that arc, well, first of all, the charged particles from the sun are not creating an arc. That aurora light is those charged particles hitting the oxygen and nitrogen in the atmosphere and creating light. But that's not an arc. So the radio signal it creates directly, it is my guess it's going to be very weak. Over to you, Roy, KQRIW.
Well, Well, also you have to consider that it's being contained and concentrated in the magnetic fields of the Earth. I mean, I don't know if it's a legitimate number. I know that it's not completely insane, and people have proposed it as a theory and have working ideas of experiments somewhere down the line. So there's anything that's, to my knowledge, is fundamentally flawed about it. It may not be the reason. It may be something completely different. You may be completely right that the intensities are too low for it to manifest any kind of sensory. I don't know. Like I said before, all these things are conjecture and theory. They have no proof on almost any aspect of lightning and thunder. They're not even 100% sure of what causes the charges in the clouds and such. So, you know, he got good guesses, but only guesses at this time. Anyone have any other comments about lightning, thunder, or clouds? There's also things called brontides. Brontides are much more nonspecific thunder noises in the background as opposed to the sharp thunder that you hear when lightning strikes nearby. But that's about as far as... there's a lot of things on lightning and thunder, but still, again, a mystery to in many, many ways. Does anyone have any kind of questions or comments? Otherwise, I'll move on to the next topic. Okay, and again, if you want to see a very nice YouTube on the subject that was released a day or two ago, just type in lightning.ac2gs.com, and that'll bring you directly to a very nice YouTube. My subject for tonight is something called Icarus. Some astronomers call MACS J1149 plus 223 Lenstar 1, which is why everyone wants to call it Icarus. Icarus was the farthest star seen so far in the history of astronomy. It's 9 billion light years away. It's a blue supergiant star that's a very short-lived one at that. And the way that they found it was quite amazing. Let me drop. They were actually looking at a supernova that was called SN Refstal. And they were using a galactic cluster about 5 billion light years away as a gravitational lens to amplify the light. As we know from Einstein's relativity, gravity can bend light, and it can bend it into a lens-like object. Instead of a focal point, gravitational lenses have focal lines, but you can utilize them to magnify more distant images. So this supernova was being magnified by the 5 billion light year away galactic cluster. And then they noticed this strange thing lighting up over the years. And they did some studies, and they found that it was a blue giant. Let me drop. So it was a blue giant single star. It wasn't a supernova. Supernovas are thousands of times brighter than blue giants. But for some odd reason, they were picking it up. And they figured out that the reason that they were picking it was because of another phenomenon. It's not exactly gravitational lensing. It's called a gravitational microlensing. If you will, it's a gravitational lens inside the initial gravitational lens. And what was going on was a star about the size of our sun was lined up perfectly with Icarus, and it changed the magnification from the usual 50 times magnification that a galactic cluster will give you to 1,000 times, and that caused us to actually be able to see this incredible blue giant that was 9 billion light years away from us. And the problem is, we found this out in 2016. By now, it's invisible, because that star that acts as a micro-lensing device has moved out of alignment. But some astronomers are optimistic that another star will line up in that cluster again and give us something that may be even brighter. Micro lensing can give you as much as 10,000 times magnification of these distant stars. So put it down in your history books. This is the oldest, farthest away single star we've ever seen. Let me drop. Now keep in mind that this is an image in the past. This star that we're looking at, or we looked at 2 years ago, was sending that light out 9 billion years ago. The life expectancy for a blue giant is not that long. It's tens of millions of years. So chances are, a long, long time ago, probably before our sun even burst into light, that blue star collapsed into either a black hole or a neutron star. So we're seeing a ghost from the past, but it's sort of an exciting ghost from the past. So that's my little story of Icarus. I also have some places that you can find out more about Icarus. If you type in your browser icarus.ac2gs.com, it'll give you a very nice nature article. Let me drop. And if you type in Icarus 2 without a space, .ac2gs.com, it gives you a very nice YouTube that was produced only a few days ago. That was a nice, very nice presentation on the Icarus supergiant. So that's my little spiel about Icarus. Anyone have any questions or comments about Icarus?
WS2N. And I do after, after Paul. Go ahead, Roy.
Yes, Paul. Ask away. Comment away.
And all the different reading that you did, did they tell you what the record was previous to the 9 billion light years away? Did they double the distance? Just another billion miles out? What kind of information did they give you? I know it's hard to even find any kind of a star in distant galaxies. So I'm just wondering if they had where'd he beat? Back to you.
The previous record, to my knowledge, was 50 million light years away. So it beat it by a wide margin.
Wow, okay, very good. Yeah, that's a big change. Originally, when they first found the star, I think it was in Andromeda. That was a big deal. Hubble did that. And now they're looking at 9 billion years. Andromeda is only, 2 million light years away. Very good, Roy. Good information.
Now, there are galaxies that have been seen much further, but an average-sized galaxy is 100 billion stars. So there's a hell of a lot more luminous stuff there. And I believe, by way of the Hubble Ultra Deep Field photograph, I believe some of those very red-shifted galaxies that we see are tiny little red dots that the James Webb Telescope is waiting patiently for that to give them a much better view of these things. But I think they've been seen at numbers like 13 billion light years away, but that's 100 billion stars. So galaxy, it's a lot easier to see at a long distance than a single star. So this is the greatest record holder of a single star. However, by way of the Hubble constant, things that are further away are more and more redshifted. That Hubble Deep Field picture, all of the very large distant objects are very dim red objects. How can this star at that distance be a blue giant? Maybe they call it blue because they've unshifted it mathematically. But wouldn't it be red, heavily redshifted at that distance because it's moving away from us at a great rate? AC2GS, K2RIW.
Yes, Dick. All of these distant celestial bodies are deeply redshifted. The nomenclature of the color, whether it's a red giant or a blue giant is a local phenomenon based upon its black body radiation, its size, its temperature, and what have you. It's not based upon visual inspection from a redshifted consequence.
In the photographs that they supply, which maybe are an artist conception, the star in question looked blue in those photographs. And if it was a untouched photograph, I think the star should have been very redshifted. Okay, Roy.
I would agree with you, and NASA is either famous or infamous for false coloring pictures to make them look better. They add colors, they add contrast, they add all kinds of artistic things. But I'm not even sure how visible red it is. I think a great deal of its signal is probably in the near infrared. I haven't really seen any nice numbers about that. But I'm wondering how deeply redshifted the whole thing was. But yeah, the blue coloration is just NASA playing with their Photoshop. So does anyone have any questions or comments about good old Icarus, our farthest away single star? You got to realize, as you said, Dick, they have found galaxies, which are obviously much, much brighter than a single star, as far as 13.6 billion light years away. The supernova that they were watching is brighter than the average star. A blue giant is pretty bright. The blue giants are more than a couple of thousand times brighter than our sun. So it was a bright object, but without 2,000 times magnification, we wouldn't have seen anything, redshifted or not.
A comet?
Yes, John?
My question is, if this star is located in a galaxy that is lining up with this lensing effect, shouldn't another star in this galaxy come into alignment fairly soon? Go ahead.
Well, I mean, that's the hope of astronomers. They think that they're going to get lucky on this, and they keep on looking at the same exact region. Lightning will strike again. So they're optimistic. We have no idea what the environment of that star is. We don't know if it's just a star sitting there out of no place, or if it's smack dab in the middle of a galactic supercluster. And, so they don't really know about the neighborhood, but they're hoping if there's another local star that's bright enough as a blue star, then at least another star in the lensing galactic cluster will line up and light up Icarus again. But again, they're being optimistic, and they're going to keep looking in that region and see if it lights up again.
I'm going to guess, Roy, that the possibility exists that this blue giant is not necessarily a major star inside of the galaxy. This could be a loner, if you know what I mean, a guy all by himself. One of the things that you were addressing, but not... there's a couple of extra words I'm going to try to add to it, and that is, because a star takes hydrogen, fuses it into helium, helium fuses it into lithium, and it starts climbing the periodic table until it gets to iron. So a star is, so to speak, consuming material, converting it into larger molecules in the periodic table. Common sense would lead you to believe a bigger star has more material to burn, and therefore would last longer. And it's the exact opposite. A bigger star has more mass, therefore a much stronger gravity, much higher compression in the center of the star, therefore the nuclear...
Repeater, time out.
Therefore, the nuclear fire burns much brighter, and the diameter of the center of the star that's doing the burning becomes a much larger volume. So bigger stars with more mass burn much brighter, and they burn out much faster. So a huge star might last 10 million years. Our star, a medium-sized star, they believe is going to last 10 billion years. A red dwarf star might last two or three times longer than that. So there's an inverse relationship between the size of a star and how long it lasts. And I think that's why you were saying before that this blue giant probably burned itself out even before our star came, our local sun came into existence. AC2GS, K2IW.
Yes, Ed, exactly. The bigger you are, the harder you burn, the shorter you live. And I've seen estimates of red dwarfs lasting as long as a theoretical 10 trillion years. Obviously, there's no way of proving that because the universe hasn't been around it for anything close to that. But that's some theories that some people have about red dwarfs. If you build them low enough and slow enough and not terribly hot enough, they can go on and on forever. And the bigger you build them, the shorter they live.
AC2IS query.
Yes, Bill.
Since we're talking about the star that's frozen from us that we've been able to observe, I started thinking about sort of the size of the universe and sort of what is the speed of light in relation to the size of the universe. I think I've heard somebody say, I don't know if this is true or not, that the Earth, our solar system is kind of the Earth, is sort of much more RF hot due to all the radio broadcasting that we do here than any other observable star that we've seen. And I don't know if that's really the case. But I guess my question is, along the lines of looking for life in the rest of the universe, if there are, if life is somewhat common out there, and if they do produce radio signals, what are the odds that that other life, whatever other point in the universe, assuming it's far away, that their RF signals are going to get to us in a time frame where you would notice them, maybe we're going to die out long before some other civilization signals get to us, even though maybe they existed a long time before us. Is that question making any kind of sense? Go ahead.
Yeah, sure, Bill, it makes sense. As far as the universe, we have a problem with semantics. There's the observable universe, and that's the distance that we can simply see because light has had an opportunity to get to us. And so the light cone that we can see around is approximately 13.8 billion light years. Anything beyond that, light hasn't had a chance to reach us, so we don't see it. Now, it might be an inch away from that boundary, might be the end of whatever it is we call a universe, or it could be a thousandfold, billionfold, trillionfold. We have absolutely no idea how big the actual universe is, if there's just one of them. And so, observable universe is the only thing we can go on. As far as communicating with other civilizations, civilizations that have technology are not as long-lived as life in general. Life has been around on this planet for a billion years, but RF technology has been around in this world for about 120 years. So And a lot of these things have, these distances from one planet to another are, can be millions of light years. So to pinpoint a planet where they'll be able to pick up your RF when the RF gets there is problematic, and with the 1 over R squared, you'd probably need a heck of a lot of power.
Okay, Stacy, so I ask here, so you're saying that even though we're transmitting a lot, because the rest of the universe is so far away from us, that seems pretty insignificant. Whereas, quasars, do they spread out light, or do they also spit out RF? I'm not sure. But I think that you've been able to absorb a lot of things spitting out RF, you know? So maybe we are not really that RF hot compared to other solar systems. But you're saying that we can only see 13 billion light years away from us, presumably because the universe is only about 13 billion years old. Is that correct? Maybe so, yeah.
Well, it's not because of the age, it's just because of the distances, that any light that was emitted, at the farthest we can see, because it took 13.8 billion years for light to reach us from the outer edge of the observable universe, that there could be other things beyond that. But it's just we're locked in by the constant of the velocity of the speed of light. If you doubled the velocity of the speed of light, we'd be able to look twice as, if you doubled it, we'd be able to look twice as far out beyond our point. So it's primarily a limitation to the speed of light in the vacuum.
Bill, when you're now going through the Sheldon repeater, and you could use quite a bit more audio. Maybe the audio on that particular link is set low tonight. When you Google the word Schwarzschild radius, the so-called event horizon of a black hole, when you Google that word and you go to Wikipedia, Schwarzschild radius, they give you quite a few pages of information. And one of the pieces of information they give you is how to calculate what's the diameter of that event horizon of a black hole, the Schwarzschild radius. And the equation is 2mg over c squared. So g is the big gravitational constant. M is the amount of total mass of the black hole divided by c squared. Okay. The universe that we know of, average galaxy is 100 billion stars, and there's roughly 100 billion galaxies. 100 billion, by the way, is 10 to the 11th power. So 100 billion stars, 100 billion galaxies, 10 to the 22. You take the mass of 10 to the 22 solar masses. Let me drop. And you plug it into that equation. And that Wikipedia article about the Schwarzschild radius tells you that the total mass of our observable universe calculates a Schwarzschild radius of 13.7 billion light years. That would suggest that although you take all of the expanding universe that we see and you play it backwards, and you believe the Big Bang took place 13.7 or 13.8 billion years ago, but the total mass that we see calculates a Schwarzschild radius of 13.7 billion years. Does that mean we are living inside of a black hole? The article doesn't say that. I'm asking that question. Ain't that crazy? AC2GS, K2LIW.
Yes, that was a strange thought. I was going to suggest that maybe this 13 billion light years of the observable universe is maybe related to the rate of expansion of the universe. And that maybe at a certain point things are outside of 13 billion years away from us are moving away from us at greater than the speed of light. So maybe that's why their light is not reached us. Does that make sense?
You've got it, Roy.
Well, yeah, I mean, the problem with the speed of light is everyone kind of sees it as a limitation that you can't go faster than the speed of light. But the story supposedly is that during the inflationary aspect, you can create space at a rate that's faster than the amount of volume that light travels in that time. And so you can expand the universe to be much, much bigger, much, much faster, and be beyond the border of the speed of light that gives us the visible light cone that we presently have. So that's kind of what's going on with the reason why we can only see one subset of this universe. We're kind of locked in to a little ball, and there's stuff beyond the ball, and everything's kind of flying away and accelerating away at us. And it's beyond the distance that light can travel in the time scheme of the creation of the universe for us to find it. And again, all the things that we are seeing at the boundaries, these things that are going on at 13.6 and 13.7, are way back in the prehistory of time. So we're not seeing the universe as it is today or last week or last Wednesday. We're seeing it at the very dawn of creation, which kind of makes it even more problematic. So, you know, what would you see beyond that, even if you could somehow see, if you're going back in time as well? So you go, you effectively see something before anything happened, which would lead to nothing. So that's another way you might want to wrap your head around the limitations of the distances that we could observe.
There's even one more way of looking at it. Let me get the beeps. My impression of the Hubble Ultra Deep Field picture, when you look at the things that are heavily redshifted, tiny appearing galaxies, heavily redshifted at the maximum range of that shot, and you look at the density of stuff at the perimeter of the observable stuff in that picture, it's not getting sparse. In other words, if our galaxy was, if our observable universe was something extremely finite and nothing is beyond it, you'd expect the limit of what you can see, the stuff to start getting very sparse. And I don't think they've said that. I think the density out at the limit of what you can see is similar to the density of the stuff in close. So we're not getting to an observable limit. That strongly suggests that beyond what you can see, there probably is a hell of a lot of stuff. And for us to think there was only one Big Bang, and that we're in the middle of that only Big Bang, and that everything we see is all there is, and there's nothing beyond that, it has to be awfully arrogant and short-sighted, nearsighted, myopic, to think that's true. All of the history we've got tells us every time we try to figure out the size of things, we're always heavily underestimating. Over to you, Roy, KQLAW.
AC2GS. Yes, we always underestimate. But by the way, you're quoting the old numbers for the number of galaxies in this universe. The latest numbers that they've come to are 2 billion galaxies. A lot of them are proto-galaxies because, again, they're very, very far out into the edges, into the early history of the universe, but it's now up to 2 billion. And generally speaking, physicists believe that the universe is almost extremely isotropic. There are variations, but the variations are very, 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 very small. And as we talked before, that's the reason why a lot of people went to the idea of inflation, because you had to somehow explain how things that are so separated are so similar to each other. And the thing that they came up with is this very strange inflationary theory where things happen at the first 10 to the minus fifth second of the first second of time, and they have imaginary time and all kinds of stuff. And what I particularly find annoying is the aspect that the total mass energy of this universe is actually zero.
Roy, up till now they've thought that there's an average galaxy, 100 billion stars, and approximately 100 billion galaxies observable. Rough number, 100 or 200 billion galaxies. You said 2 billion. I wonder if you meant 2 trillion galaxies. Over to you, Roy, KTRIW.
Yes, I'm very sorry. Yes, 2 trillion. The previously that I heard was the 200 billion, and now they upped it to 2 trillion. So they're up by a factor of 10 once again. And who knows? They'll probably raise that at some point in the future.
You gotta think big.
That's basically all of astronomy. You have to think big and then think bigger still. I mean, it's really it gives you a sense of what, you know, what a single person or a single planet or a single star system or a single galaxy is worth in a universe with so much stuff so far away from each other. And here we sit talking about it.
AC2IS query.
Yes, Bill.
Just to visit my original question, it seems that the answer is yes. If we assume that there, life occurs somewhat evenly distributed throughout the universe, but still very far apart, it seems very likely that there could be life out there. That we've only been transmitting for less than, say, 200 years, or certainly less than 300 years. If they've only started transmitting like a million years ago, it seems very likely that there could be several of those civilizations out there, and just they're so far away that we're observing the prehistory of their solar systems and not anywhere near seeing any of their transmissions yet. Does that sound right? AC2IS.
I've got an opinion on this one. I'll back to you, Roy.
Well, I think in theory you're quite right. I think that the law of averages speaks that there's got to be a lot of life in the universe. There are just too many chances for it. And some life is sentient. There's nothing magical about sentience that requires life to become sentient, but I think there's more than a good chance of that, and with that comes technology. I don't know what the lifespan of a technological species will be. I hope that we have a nice long run of it, but I don't know if that's possible. But the problem is things like pulsars. You got to realize the magnitude of the emissions are a million fold, and they're all coherent signals. They're in phase. Whereas the mishmash of RF that we give to the galaxy is just noise, and also a lot of it has cultural touchstones. If another species of technological life form picked up, the Jeffersons or something, would they have the faintest idea what the hell they were looking at?
There have been some calculations done, Bill. If you take the biggest radio telescope we've got, either the 1,000-foot diameter Arecibo dish or the 300-meter diameter large telescope at Green Bank, West Virginia, and you put a really potent transmitter on it, and you transmit a signal in some known good direction, and you assume that they have similar hardware on the other side, how much range could we get? And the answer is, I don't remember the exact answer, but it's a relatively small number of light years. We're not talking about 1,000 light years, 1,000,000 light years, 1,000,000,000 light years. We're talking about a small number of light years. It is the maximum range of communication, not counting the time delay, just the strength of signal, inverse square law, how far could we communicate with similar equipment that we're capable of using right now. And it's not a very big number. It's a very small fraction of the observable universe. Let me drop. And to give you one other example, the furthest piece of hardware mankind has ever issued is Voyager. Voyager is out there at 130 astronomical units. It takes 37 hours round trip for the radio signal at the speed of light to get out to Voyager and come back. The free space loss between us and Voyager is 315 decibels one way. You can see that inverse square law starts building up real fast. So the biggest telescope you've got, with the highest gain antenna, with the biggest transmitter we've got, we can only be heard a certain number of light years away, an extremely small fraction of even the diameter of this galaxy as I see it. So we need a lot bigger antennas and a hell of a lot more power. And we're not even close to the amount of energy emitted by some of these quasi-stellar objects. They put out 10 to the 40 watts, and we transmit 10 to the 10 watts, if you know what I mean. We're very shy. Back to you for any further comment on that one, Bill. AC2IS, K2LAW, and then pass it back to Roy.
Okay, then, here's a question for Roy. If we can only effectively communicate over a small number of light years, then let's pick a number, like, say, how many solar systems are there within 10 light years of us? Roy?
To my knowledge, not many. I mean, you're really talking about next-door neighbors at this point. Maybe Alpha Centauri, I think, is about 6 or 7. You probably know better than I do, Dick. But that's really, there's not much in the neighborhood.
I think the number for Alpha Centauri is 4.3 light years. So that's our nearest neighbor, 4.3. I don't know the exact number, but if we're good for 10 light years, and the closest star is 4.3, I'll be amazed if there's more than 10 or 15 solar systems within our observable distance. And now, for that communication to take place, our highest gain antenna, with a fraction of 1 degree of beam width, has to be precisely aimed at that star, and they, with similar equipment on their side, with a fraction of a degree of beam width of a high gain antenna aimed exactly at us. You can see the probabilities are not super, super high right now. The search for extraterrestrial intelligence is quite a strong leap of faith. The chances of finding something real soon with the SETI searches is not super high, and that's one of the reasons why getting finances for that operation is not very easy. Over to you, Bill, and then turn it over to Roy. You got it, Bill.
I think that's it for me. So, over to Roy. Roy.
Okay, AC2GS. I think, unfortunately, the only way to have any chance is wait until we're technologically advanced enough to be able to engineer and modulate a neutron star, because I don't think we have the power output that we need for the job. And even then, it's a very chancy move. It'll be interesting to see if mankind is ever able to do something wacky like that. Any other comments, questions, or answers? Icarus and gravitational lensing, micro-lensing in the universe and everything inside of it. Okay, once again, I have some websites. If you go to chris.ac2gs.com, that's a very nice article from Nature on the subject and the discovery of Icarus back in 2016. And another one is Icarus2, without a space, .ac2gs.com. to you a YouTube presentation of Icarus, and they're both very nice. So unless anyone has any other further questions, I have a very, very short topic that we can do in the next 5 or so minutes, and then give Paul his base report.
And to NBR.
Yes, and to NBR.
Wondering if there's anything in the contents of the light from, for example, Alpha Centauri that tells us anything about that time, you know, in that point in time.
Not quite sure what you mean by point in time. It's 4 years ago.
Well, because of presence of I mean, they're allegedly they are our closest neighbor, but that would theoretically give us the most information, and I was just wondering if there's any information that is available to us other than the existence of that system. Is there anything that we have learned in the last 50 to 100 years about Alpha Centauri is what I'm trying to say? He might be asking, are there planets in the habitable zone that we know about around Alpha Centauri? Over to you, Roy.
Okay, that's a good question. I wish I had a good answer. I know I think it's a binary star system. Binary star systems are very, 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 very common. And so I think Alpha Centauri is a binary star system. But I'm not really aware of what kind of research was done. They're doing some excellent astronomical assessments of planets by noting the perturbations of the star rotation that's due to gravitational forces of local planets, inferring planets from them. I'm sure they've done it long ago with Alpha Centauri. I'm just not aware of the results. I don't think there were anything great, because otherwise I would have read a lot of science fiction about visiting Alpha Centauri, and there's not really that much fiction, so I assume there's not that much nonfiction on planets in Alpha Centauri.
WS2N.
Paul, you know a lot of Alpha Centauri. Tell us.
Yeah, they did discover one planet that might be in a habitable zone in Alpha Centauri, and it's one of these planets that they plan on visiting. There's this guy, Yuri Milner, I think his name is. He's Russian. He's got like $1 billion, and he's putting money to a program called, I think it's Starshot. He wants to take thousands of these little, they look like chips, and it's going to be little lights, you know, little sails attached to them. And eventually, like, you know, 20 years from now, he plans on shooting lasers at these things and aiming it toward Alpha Centauri. And he thinks within about 20 years or so, he can get up to, I think, 20% of light speed with this system. In about 20 years or so, they should be able to get there and collect information. So there's been some research, and apparently there is a planet there worth looking at. Stephen Hawking was in favor of this program as well. Yuri something or other. You can put an M. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, it sounds fascinating. I mean, I'm sure there's a few thousand engineering problems with this idea. You can't break it. You can't kind of maneuver that much. I don't know exactly how much power you can generate as it goes away from you, you know, 1/r² again. So it's going to be a very powerful laser that's probably going to take up a good portion of a continent to do something like that. And then you got to figure how you're going to power that thing back to send you any kind of a signal. But I'm all for science. So So I hope they do something along those lines. I kind of concerned of the engineering feats that are required to accomplish it, but, you know, what the heck? People need to dream.
For those of you who really like astronomy as a science, as a hobby, definitely Google the word NEAF, November Echo Alpha Foxtrot, which stands for Northeast Astronomy Forum. They've got a great big meeting. This is about the 20th one in a row, on April 21 and April 22, 2 weeks from today. You Google NEAF, and you'll see that they've got hundreds of vendors of telescope material, thousands of people who will visit the forum that takes place at Rockland Community College, which is a few miles above New York City. It's within our driving distance. Arguably, it's the biggest astronomy forum open to the public in the United States. People who have attended it usually have very positive things to say about it. Let me drop it. You go to their website, you'll see some, they fill up the whole great big athletic stadium with vendors, and during those 2 days, all kinds of telescopes are purchasable, telescope hardware purchasable, tremendous lectures given by very famous people from NASA, and for instance, the leaders of the James Webb Space Telescope are going to be giving a lecture this coming forum. So if you have the slightest interest in the subject, Google those words, NEAF, and start reading, and you might decide you really want to be there. Over to you, Roy, K2LAW.
Very good, Dick. I wrote it down, I'll look it up, and I'll read about it. So, unless someone has some other questions or comments about Icarus and the subject that we had, you know, it's coming up to 11 o'clock. I want to give Paul a chance to give us the space report. I just want to keep in everyone to keep in mind the email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. If you have a question, if you have a topic that you want expanded upon, feel free to email me.
NWS2N, one comment on that Starshot program. Yeah, Roy, we did cover it. Net number 272, I'm able to go back to that. So, but a little over a year ago. I'm showing October 2017. So, yeah, it's called the Starshot program.
Net tonight at 8 o'clock. This is the W2VL Amateur Radio Repeater System.
Okay, very good, Paul. It's, you know, people should kind of dip into the archive. You might hear all kinds of things that you forgot that you heard once before.
Yeah, he's got a picture of this thing he wants. One of these things that he would send. It's got a mini gyroscope, magnetometer, solar cells, little antenna, a little radio. So that's the deal. His name is Milner. So it's Yuri Milner, M-I-L-N-E-R, if you want to look him up. He's out there. And he pours millions of dollars into this type of thing. Back to you, Roy.
But the problem, as I see it, is even in these solar-powered devices, you know, they put large sheets of reflected material and get the bounce off of the solar wind. Eventually, you get far enough away from the sun that it's just not giving you too much propulsion. So I don't know exactly. I mean, did he mention the power output of his Earth-based engine that's going to stream light particles at this thing?
I have it here somewhere, but he's talking about firing 100 gigawatts. But I can't imagine it. I don't think we're going to live to see this, but this guy's, you know, he poured a lot of money, $100 million he put into this already, but the target price would be about $10 billion. So, I don't think we're going to be around for this one. Back to you.